You are listening to season two of Wake Up or Breakup with your host, LCB. Are you ready to get started? Let's go. All right, you guys, welcome to another episode of Wake Up or Breakup. Today is a special day. I actually have a life coach, relationship coach, divorce coach with me on today. And what's special about Simon is that when I was going through my coaching training, we needed to look for a senior coach. And this was probably, I don't know, like a few months after Joe and I broke up, and I saw his profile and he said that, you know, he helps people deal with divorce or at the breaking point before divorce. And I was like, oh my God, this is my person. I need to find him. I need to talk to him. So I messaged him and he helped me so much. And it was funny because although he was like a divorce coach, he helped me in so many other relationships in my life. And I wanted to have him on today because I want y'all to have this insight of someone who's worked with people who were at the breaking point, who've dealt with infidelity. So before, you know, I just take over the whole thing, Simon, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Elsie, for that very generous introduction.
Yeah. I'm happy that people can kind of see your perspective, because a lot of times we're hearing the stories, you know, of people who have been cheated on, but as like a mediator, like an unbiased party, give us a little background, I guess, first of your coaching background and your history.
Sure. I'm trained as a lawyer, mediator, and negotiator. So a lot of my career has been related to that type of work, and especially in human resources. And about 5 years ago, I started getting interested in coaching, and fast forward and until today, after which I got my CTW coach certificate and training. And because of my own personal journey and experience, I was really drawn to helping people who are considering divorce or are working through challenging relationship issues. And that's kind of how I landed in this space of breakup, divorce, or relationship coaching. And so that's kind of consolidated, like, brief summary. But so most of my work is about 50% of my clients are folks who are thinking about divorce, getting divorced, sort of evaluating and planning and executing sort of their post-divorce life.
You know, it's such a specific niche. Like, what made you choose this type of coaching niche?
Yeah, so I got divorced in 2017. And divorce was a foreign thing for me entirely. My parents were married until my dad passed away in June for over 42 years.
Oh, wow.
And everyone in my, you know, my elders, you know, the generation above, sort of that raised me, they're almost all of them are married. So when I got divorced, it was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like, I didn't plan my life this way. It was just like an enormous shock to the system on every possible level. Trained as a lawyer, I kind of knew what the legal issues were, but I had no, like, what happens? I mean, I was married for 14 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what is, you know, will I date again? You know, is that what I want? And as a father too, that kind of complicated things a little bit. So going from pretty much what I would describe to be the pits of hell for me to where I am now, involved having to learn and master or get familiar with every possible reference point that I could find. Mm-hmm. Podcasts, YouTube videos, and that helped spur my desire to help other people. As I was kind of like lifting myself up and trying to figure out my way forward, I saw that as a man in particular, there was no place for me to get help other than maybe a therapist, which didn't seem to fit me 100%. And I created a meetups group. And in the process of creating a meetups group, I was able to get, I went from zero to 120 meetups members in like a month.
Oh, wow.
So that told me there's a need out there, right?
Yeah.
And the more I talked to people, the more it was like people are floundering. Like, they were struggling. They didn't know where to start. Like, even the simple details of like finances, even post-divorce, like how do we deal with that? If I haven't worked for 10 years because I was raising a child, how do I get back into the workforce? What if I can't afford an apartment, or I can't afford to, you know? So those were the realities that people were grappling with. Layered on top of it was all the emotional stuff.
Yeah.
You know? So that was like, holy cow, people need help. And how can I make sense of my situation and help other people at the same time?
Yeah, you said that, you know, you went from 0 to 100. Was that mostly men in the meetup group?
It was mixed.
Oh.
It was the meetups group was just like, this is like a divorce support group with, you know, my goal was to just teach people about the process. Not focus on the legal, because it's like, if you want legal advice, go to a lawyer. But beyond that, like, there are a lot of realities. When you build a life with someone for a very long time, mm-hmm. And you have, you know, all these layers and connections, family, friendships, relationships, there's emotions and all these things, people don't, they're stuck. They're really frightened. And it helped them enormously to see other people like them able to pull through, right? Able to make sense of it and move forward with their lives. So it was all kinds of folks. It was men, women, gay, straight, parents, non-parents. You know, a combination, do-it-yourself divorces versus the fancy all-out battle divorce.
Yeah, everyone needs help.
It was a real mix, yeah, yeah, yeah.
What would you say, like, as far as your clients go, is it the same? Like, it's a mixed group, or do you have, you know, more of one gender than the other, or?
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with everybody, but I would say a substantial part of my divorce clientele are men.
Oh.
But I've also worked with a lot with women as well.
Oh, I'm curious, you know, working with this mixed group of people, do you find that the people who are seeking help are people, and I'm referring to people who have experienced infidelity, because, you know, that's kind of the jam of the podcast, but
yes.
Do you find that a lot of the people are the people who have been cheated on, or are they the people who committed the cheating? What would you say is
the
ratio?
Ones who seek help?
Yeah, the ones who seek help from you.
I don't know if I could break the numbers down to that level, because, you know, my role as a coach is to really support the individual through their journey. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know that I, you know, the narrative I get is the narrative of the person who experienced it in their way. So yeah. I've never actually coached with a couple to see what the competing or the sort of the other person's side would be. But in terms of attribution of like causes, I would say that I've definitely seen all the usual suspects that cause the demise of a relationship, as well as some of the other sort of less well-known ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess it's kind of a mixed bag. And I would tell you that the normal, you know, everybody suspects that infidelity is the main cause. Mm-hmm. Of breakups. I have anecdotal, right? I don't have the data behind it. I know that infidelities, insofar as there's a divorce, people will cite to that among other things. But, you know, I do firmly believe that there are also plenty of relationships that survive infidelity, just, you know, they come out better on the other end. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for me to pinpoint to say, you know, I have one typical client. Does that make sense?
No, yeah, that does make sense. And I like that you said, well, what piqued my curiosity is you said there's like the not so typical reason.
Yeah.
What is that? I mean, can you share?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and let me step back from it and just acknowledge that, and I may have alluded to this earlier, that, you know, there are modalities and frames and theories that we can look through to understand relationships and make sense of things that happen, right? And then there are the individual stories that people have, and they're not the same thing. Mm-hmm. Because we can, you know, there are a lot of great books and resources on attachment theory and all that stuff, but I guess what I get to experience through my clients is their individual story, their individual experience. I'm sorry, you asked me the question, I just totally blanked.
No, it was like that other group that...
Oh, the other, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was getting there, right? So the first groupings are the usual suspects that end a relationship, right? Which are, infidelity is clearly one of the big ones. There are other forms like things that, you know, addiction is a big, can really cause a big problem in a relationship. It doesn't even have to necessarily be drugs. It could be drugs, alcohol, it could be gambling, financial, I guess the term I'd use is financial infidelity, where you're spending, the partners have an understanding or relationship around money, and then somebody spends money on the side on something else, or, you know, or there's a secret bank account, things like that, when there's a betrayal discovered. You know, all those are kind of things that we would suspect. Illness is something that comes up periodically that could really end a relationship.
Oh, wow.
You know, because it could put enormous stress. But then there are the salient ones that I think that the Gottmans write about and talk about a lot that I think are really, really important. If you want to be strong in your relationship, you kind of have to be aware of these. And those are what they call the four horsemen, right? Contempt, defensiveness, criticism, and resentment. Mm-hmm. And those are the, like, they fuel the low grade warfare between couples. And if they evolve too much, they can get hardwired into the relationship dynamics and the communication dynamics, and those are the salient, those are the quiet ones, the killers that, you know, there isn't one dramatic event. Mm-hmm. It's over time where people just kind of tend to start to lose, not be respectful of each other, and they're just hurtful to the point where one person just has enough. It's interesting, I think, that relationships, it takes two to make it work. And it takes only one person to end it.
Yeah.
So end can be done unilaterally, but success, it takes bilateral effort. And then the other, I think, modern salient killer that I think I've noticed creeps up a lot in both male and female clients is child raising and the roles that individuals can get stuck in.
Oh.
Yeah. So if one person or another starts to feel like they're isolated into a specific exclusionary role as, like, you know, only the breadwinner and husband, then over time in a long-term relationship, what I found is especially in the men that I work with, they're like, that's when the midlife crisis hits. And they just kind of they want to feel alive. And so that might contribute to behaviors and things that can really put pressure in a relationship. And it could, you know, it's one contributor to motives that, you know, behind infidelity.
What's coming to my mind right now is when you talk about, like, and if you guys aren't familiar or listening to this, John Gottman is amazing. Like, he is like a relationship scientist. So he could predict the success of a marriage up to, like, I think 98% accuracy. It's insane. And so if you're looking for a resource to help your personal marriage, please, the 7 principles to a successful marriage is, like, amaze. Totally. But that being said, what really, like, stood out for me is when you're talking about these salient factors, you know, these unspoken things like the four horsemen, and it's almost like tiered, you know, like that could break the relationship, just the resentment, contempt, things like that. But then it can escalate into infidelity, gambling, betrayal of some sort. And it just depends on your tolerance level, you know, like maybe resentment's enough for you and you're like, well, I'm done with this, you know, and right. Maybe it's infidelity and maybe it's gambling and maybe it's like, nah, I'll take all of it. You know, we'll stay together.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also think that, like, it's interesting that some relationships can tolerate pressures that other relationships can't. And so one thing I've noticed is, you know, when a couple, especially if they're in a long-term relationship, they've been married a long time, they really want the relationship, they really, you know, they're trying to make it work, but they've cemented practices into their relationship that have already caused so much damage. So that by the time they go to counseling, you know, you're talking about stuff that has been in the works for a very long time.
Yeah.
And then in counseling, they just sort of repeat the stuff that happened. And so you have this dynamic where they're not listening to each other. And I think those relationships are less capable of tolerating the pressures of a long-term relationship, right? Whether it's like, infidelity or, or some, gambling or addiction problems. Like, it's harder to listen to your partner if you've developed such animosity toward them that you already know that they're the crappy gambler or whatever. Mm-hmm. You've already put them in a box in your head.
Yeah. You had mentioned in our pre-conversations about, you help people who are considering or they're executing their divorce or post-divorce. Like,
right.
Do you have a success rate? Like, do people come and see you when they're at the breaking point and end up staying together? And what does that usually entail? Like, what saves a marriage when they're at the breaking point and they come see you?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I'm very much let the client drive the session. And so if they come to me with the question, well, should I stay? Of course I remind them that's something that they have the answer to. And I help them with the process to kind of identify what's right for them. It's my anecdotal perception based on a lot of my experience that by the time they're already talking to me, they've kind of already made up their mind in a mm-hmm. sense. Mm-hmm. There's a great book out there written by a divorce lawyer the title is If You're in My Office, It's Too Late. And it's lessons about relationships and marriage from a divorce lawyer. Paxton is his last name, I think. And so I kind of feel similarly, you're approaching me and you want the answers, but of course I'm fascinated with the questions. That's my interest. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that my hope is that I can use the questions as mirrors so that the client can decide their own pathway forward. Mm-hmm. What I like to ask people, I do want to encourage folks to ask themselves whether they have put forth the effort to make the relationship work, mm-hmm. right? Because, especially when a client has had, it's been a long-term relationship, there's a lot invested and the client wants to make it work. I help the client discover what avenues are available. But the fact of the matter is that in many cases, they've already kind of tried it. They're kind of looking for their own validation to move forward. I will say though that I work with people who are not, I want people to be receptive and resourceful. So that's something I screen for in my clients to begin with. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, if someone's experiencing abuse or any kind of neglect, that's a reason people not to stay in a relationship at all. Mm-hmm. I don't want to ignore that at all, because some people stay in relationships and there's circumstances around it, it's really not safe.
Yeah. And that might be helpful, if you don't mind kind of clarifying for people the differences between coaching and therapy, because when it does come to things like abuse, addiction, things like that, you're kind of in trauma that's kind of borderlining on therapy. And you do such a thorough job, I feel like, even with me, of, kind of figuring out where your client is at the starting point. So do you mind kind of sharing, just for people listening, what the differentiation is?
Yes, absolutely. Therapy is a helping profession. Coaching is not. Therapists help people deal with trauma, learn about their past, and find healing. My main responsibility as a coach is to leverage the client's internal powers so the client can create a pathway forward and act on his or her desires and wishes. I'm not as interested in the client's past beyond what the client wants to tell me, and I'm not providing therapy or any type of therapeutic value looking to make the client feel better, get diagnosed, anything like that. My role is more a matter of, kind of helping the client realize that they're really their best ally, mm-hmm. and that their answers and, their sort of way forward actually resides in them. Mm-hmm. And so I guess, when I have a client presented to me for the first time, I'm I'm really looking to see, is this person, do they appear to me like fragile, brittle? Like, are they crying a lot? Are they upset? Are they capable of, you know, clear thought? Do they know what they want out of this relationship? Are we able to form a connection, a trusting connection? Are they able to trust me and in the process? And if I get the sense that, you know, they're generally capable, so that's when I use these terms, receptive and resourceful. If they fit those types of things, if they're receptive and resourceful, and they look like they know what's, you know, they're capable of having a conversation and understand what's best for them, then it's usually fine. But if the client is, like I said, if they're upset, if they're crying a lot, if they essentially look like they can't make decisions for themselves, mm-hmm. then I will not take them on as a client. Mm-hmm. I will refer them too if I can.
Yeah. And I think that's very honest. You know, you've touched a little bit here and there about what you offer as a coach. Like, what would you say is the benefit of someone who is at the breaking point coming to see you? You know, you mentioned some people are already know, you know, they may be unsure. Like, what's the benefit of seeing you?
Yeah. So number one is clarity, right? And really confronting, you know, there are all these limiting beliefs that we have around a decision, and this is where coaching is, can be kind of like, we can understand it very really broadly, like, why, you know, whether it's changing careers, right, or moving to another place, we sometimes have wishes and desires and feelings we know in our hearts to be true, mm-hmm. but we don't act on them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the what I offer the client is clarity on their own pathway. So essentially, you know, like landing a big plane, it's a big mm-hmm. responsibility. It's easier to do when your runway is lit. You know, even with radar, like, visuals are good. So that's number one, is clarity. And then number two is an action plan and accountability. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you come to me on a session and you say, God, I really want to move out. I don't feel safe in this relationship anymore. I've thought about it a lot. The only thing that's keeping me in this relationship is we have so much history together and we share a dog. You know, then I will, and you're telling me what your desire is, well, I will explore what your limiting beliefs are around that, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes people will, so like anything else, well, I you know, what's impeding your decision, right? So you work with the client to identify why is it that they believe that they won't be able to survive outside of that relationship.
Yeah.
And so, and I also work, by the way, it's not just although I've worked with a lot of divorced people, I've also worked on breakups. So,
ooh.
Which can be, yeah. So it's not in a marriage, but in a committed monogamous relationship, and similar idea where there could be a lot of limiting beliefs around action.
Mm-hmm.
And I just read a book actually that may seem relevant to what seems relevant to me, called The Four Agreements, that provides these, like, have you read it?
I love The Four Agreements.
It's pretty simple, right?
Yeah, it's like my life's mantras.
It's terrific. And, you know, for some people, they're interested in breaking up. They have all these reasons in their head, but they're also talking themselves out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's being able, you know, coaching allows someone to realize, to be outside of themselves for at least a little bit and observe and see,
mm-hmm.
look at the conversation that your sort of negative self is having with the part of you that has desires, wishes, and longings,
mm-hmm.
right? How long will you be able to suppress that part of you that really has all these, is stating all these reasons to take a different path?
Yeah.
You know, so number one is clarity, and then number two is action.
Mm-hmm. And those are, like, jam-packed, super helpful. It's like two things, but they are so much. Like, I can only talk from my own personal experience with you, but I know, like, coming into our sessions together, I didn't want to be with Joe anymore. I was pretty much done. And it's funny because the most insightful part of our sessions together weren't necessarily talking about my relationship with Joe, but it was examining the other relationships in my life and their influence on me, which affected my relationship with Joe. And you know, I could definitely say I'm one of the success stories because, you know, Joe and I are working things out, but it's so beautiful. Like, and just to say for everyone listening, like, you can go into coaching thinking you need one thing and come out finding a whole nother thing. And that whole other thing can solve all the other things.
Yes. And that was my experience both as a coach and as a client, because mm-hmm. I have coaches too. And for sure, you might think that, you know, you're really working on door number one, but it's really door number three. And I'm really glad you said that, because, I mean, it's my observation that a lot of times when I deal with clients who are struggling in their relationships, they're struggling in their relationships in part because they're struggling with themselves. Mm-hmm. So, like, not to get too stereotypical, but like the nice guy who can't draw boundaries in relationships, right? Mm-hmm. Creates dynamics in the relationship that aren't serving him. And so he's growing resentful. So notice that situation and that relationship, it has problems, but some of those are the result of the client's own, right? Almost like tendencies and personality traits shaped by their childhood in part and by genes, but they show up in their relationship in this way. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, okay, well, you know, they sometimes clients can see their patterns and sometimes they can't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in terms of like, you know, drilling down and addressing, it's like when you go into coaching, you may be thinking, and I'll use another analogous situation that's come up recently with a client who isn't getting the job that they, the promotion, and they don't understand why they're not getting the promotion because they're really, really good at their job. Mm-hmm. Right. And so they come in externally oriented, right? The environment around them is the problem. They don't understand. And then as they do the work, they start to discover, well, what personal responsibility do I have here? Mm-hmm. Right. And how am I showing up? And maybe I'm not getting the job because, well, kind of an ass, right? So you may know all this stuff and you may, you know, be great at your job, but if you're not creating the right kinds of relationships, or you're not, or you're hurting people's feelings, mm-hmm. are you ready to be a leader? Are you ready to be in management? Are you ready to be a team leader? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's part of the process, right? It's part mm-hmm. of like, that's where I have to be really, really patient as a coach. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I don't want to get too far ahead of my client. I really want to be more in tandem and parallel with them as they, mm-hmm. they walk through this situation, because it's not the role of the coach to sort of tell the client what to do, but B, it's also important that the client observe and see his or her own, contribution to their life.
Yeah, I love the way that you said it earlier, because your job isn't to give them advice, you're more like a mirror. So you're almost like just showing them the reflection of themselves that they're not able to see, and you're not even showing them the reflection like, hey, did you see that mole under your nose? It's right. Like, did you see that part of your soul that was right. hidden, that was like tucked behind here? And you know, another great point that you brought up is that the client has all the answers.
Yeah. And, you know, and I'm sorry to make reference to the book twice, but in one of the things that the Four Agreements touches upon very forcefully in the beginning is this concept of domestication. And, you know, this idea that, like, you know, I saw it once in a meme presented this way, and I thought this was hilarious. Society says, be you. Mm-hmm. And then society says, not like that. Yeah, and right. So that meme has really stuck with me, because it's like we go through, I mean, I'm 43, we go through life trying to do what's right for us, thinking we're authentic. Mm-hmm. And then we start to uncover the damage done by an environment that we're in, mm-hmm. that wants us to be a different way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another sort of salient thing that's come up in my coaching with divorced folks, is that some people are divorced because they really didn't want to get married in the beginning. Mm. And it kind of caught up to them, right?
Yeah.
So it was like this sort of like trying to shed the effect that domestication has had on them, because they were of this belief that if I get married, I'm going to be whole, I'll be fine, I'll be better, all these bad feelings I've had from the past will get organized, mm-hmm. through a romantic relationship with someone else that I've learned about as defined by movies, porn, and books, and my peers, and then everything's going to be, you know, fine.
Yeah. And I love that you reference porn. I'm like, well, that's interesting.
Porn has had, I mean, listen, I'm a father, a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, it's like access that I never had. And, you know, it's just a reality of middle school, high school. I'm sorry to say that if we don't talk to our kids, and I know we're going kind of far afield, but if we don't talk to our kids about sex, love, intimacy, they will fill that void some other way. And if we're being sort of honest with each other, in 2020, porn has played an enormous role in what people, what men, but also women, and a lot of people look to define sexual connection, sexual intimacy. And I think it's made worse now with the pandemic. But in any case, it is part of the shelf of resources that people draw on when they think about sex and connection, which is, by the way, another thing that causes, by I think, another salient contributor, or maybe not so salient contributor, to breakups and divorces, is a real inability to reconcile around issues of sex, which is a big topic.
I know, and I know you mentioned like, oh, you know, this is kind of off topic, but I think it's totally relevant, because when you think about porn and you think about just sexuality in general, it's so readily accessible now. You know, like, you go on Instagram and you see asses and cleavage and like everything, and you have these DMs where people can slide in. I mean, that's what happened with Joe. You know, like, there's all this stuff everywhere. If someone's sending you naked photos on Instagram, you know, it's hard not to entertain it if you're already in a bad place. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where you're right. I mean, there's certainly, I mean, the temptation is there on a scale that we have never seen. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, let's just talk about like just in back away from just marriage and relationships in general. I mean, it's no longer true that your pick of a mate is who's in the village. Yeah. Esther Perel talks a lot about this in Mating Captivity, which is like the modern era affords you, if you want to cheat or if you want to date, an endless assortment of options.
Yeah.
I mean, you pick your app. I mean, we're talking about, it's not just about the individuals, it's like platform. Mm-hmm. And then they have, you know, secretive type of platforms. But you're absolutely right. And so, you know, it's over time, that's where in a relationship, to make a relationship successful, you have to leave a little bit of space for the erotic, right? For the mysterious, for the unknown, for the dark and inappropriate. And that can sort of tend to feed that desire or the need internally rather than externally. But you kind of have to nurture that.
Yeah. I mean, even, you know, you bringing up Esther Perel, she has so many beautiful things about infidelity that I was listening to. You recommended a YouTube video for me and I watched it and I was like, this is so real. Because before, you didn't get married because it made you happy. You got married because, you know, it was what you needed to do. Like, financially, like, you made this union, like, business. So it was like a business contract. And now it's like, well, it's because, you know, I love you, kind of, right now. And, you know, and it's like a temporary emotion. And then you break up because of temporary emotions, you know?
Yep. You know, she says there's so much about what she says that resonates with me. You know, in particular, this, like, people got married, it was like there was an exchange, security for, you know, the roles were clear. There's usually security for, you know, sex or affection. And, you know, there was a clear roles, you know, one person makes the money, the other person keeps the home. And, you know, I guess that model worked for a period, but society has evolved even since the 1960s, and we're talking about a period of only 60 years.
Yeah.
And so now it's like, and I think what Esther Perel talks about is, you know, this notion that, you know, is, can we really expect to get everything we want, you know, from our partner, as is the romantic model that we've been, remember what I said, education, right? It's like, yeah. I was trying to, like, as I was looking at movies, I'm putting together a list of like top 10 movies people going through divorce should see, or men or people.
Yeah.
I got two different products, but you know, as this is a matter of something you kind of can manage or think about in terms of saying, okay, like what do I imagine if you had the clarity, right? What do I want my romantic partner to do for, like, what is that? What is their role? Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't imagine when I got married at 26 that I had the maturity or awareness to even have the conversation as to roles. It just became, you know, well, you're good at paying the bills, so you pay the bills, and you're good at doing the laundry, so you do the laundry. And, you know, it can really create a lot of confusion around that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, then it was clear as to roles, and the roles have been, you know, with the ability to customize comes so much potential for challenges, you know, and obstacles. You know, it's funny. Mm-hmm. I say that we get our information from, you know, about sex and intimacy from all these other resources. I should have also indicated that we don't get them from our parents, or at least I didn't, in terms of sex and intimacy.
Oh, like the specifics.
Yeah. So, like, right. Exactly. Like, I mean, that would be super awkward. I'm not advocating for it necessarily, but I give them, they're a credible resource for almost everything else that I learned about relationships that I almost took for granted because I observed them. And so it creates this remarkable dynamic. And I read a book by Plomis. His name is Plomis, that talks about her like traits, genetic traits. And there's a section in there that argues that whether you're going to get divorced is almost predetermined based on genes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Right. And it's not because you have like a mean gene or because you have an inability to get along gene. It's much more nuanced than that. It's because like people who tend to be more emotional and open people are more susceptible to divorce. And so it's sort of backwards. But anyway, trying to answer your question about, you know, in terms of what we learn from, you know, various resources, some of them are unconscious, some of them are conscious, but there's no question that we're the product of what we've learned and how we do relationships. It's remarkable to me.
What do you find, like, if you could give like just few tips, like this will help save your marriage or this will help save your relationship, like what are the top things? Because as a coach, you can't really give advice,
right? But
in this platform, if you could give advice and be like, dude, if you just did this, this, and this, you'd be golden. Like, what would you tell people?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's something that I've thought about for a while. I mean, I guess one big tip I really encourage people to do is to, it sounds so cliche, but communicate your needs, love yourself, and show up in your marriage or in your relationship as your best self. And if you can't, that's okay. If you're not doing well, that's okay. But don't expect to find happiness through somebody else. Happiness is your responsibility. And then the last thing I'd say is do everything you can. Well, there's two things, I guess, so it's not the last thing. First, the second thing is do as much as you can to discover every resource that's available to educate you and your partner, to do it together. And the third thing I say is find a sense of humor. And when shit gets really tough or awkward, make a joke, you know, because frankly, it's easier when it's lighter. And that's another skill that the Gottmans talk about that I think is really important. But I would say those things are critical.
You brought up like you're responsible for your happiness. One of my favorite things is like this picture of Will Smith and Jada Smith, and you know, he's like, her happiness is not my responsibility, it's her responsibility. I'm responsible for my happiness, and that in turn guarantees our happiness, you know. And
yeah,
people forget about that. And it goes back to that Esther Perel point of you can't expect your partner to be everything for you.
It's a very high bar if that's it. Yeah, it's absolutely true. And, you know, in terms of that Will Smith thing, I actually think, didn't they have something go on where she cheated on him? Aren't they still together or something?
Yeah, anyway. She called it an entanglement.
Oh, I like that. That's a good term, an entanglement. Yeah. And, you know, anyway, as long as I'm not here to judge or anything, I'm just think it's a good analogy a good example to cite to. But I think particularly for men, what a lot of men have heard over the years is happy wife, happy life. Mm. And I'm here to tell you, no. Your happy life is your responsibility. Her happy life is her responsibility. Share your happiness together. If you have a problem, you got to work it out. Now, I can say that easily from this vantage point, but I can tell you that actually doing it is a whole other thing. Because, you know, like, you know, that makes me think of my own personal situation, if I may briefly share, just because in my case, where I was married for a very long time, I made a lot of decisions and moves in my life for that, you know, in satisfaction of that mantra, happy wife, happy life. Move from San Francisco to Seattle. Okay, buy this house. Okay, happy wife, happy life. And it slowly eroded me as a human being,
yeah,
and contributed to my lack of confidence and desire to remain in the marriage because I was not seen or heard. Mm-hmm. So that is the danger in particular, I think, because I don't really hear the phrase, you know, happy husband, happy life. It's a phrase. And I, you know, and, you know, although, look, let's also be honest, like, we want to be good partners to each other, right? Mm-hmm. If you're in a relationship with someone else, you want to be a good partner for them. But I guess what I'm trying to argue is one of the best things you can do for your partner is to show up as your best self, your best, mm-hmm. most happy, capable self. And sometimes if you're not happy, that's okay too. Mm-hmm. You know, but doing your best to take care of you first and not making it your partner's responsibility is huge.
Yeah. And just to piggyback on that concept, for me personally, you know, if we're sharing, I didn't know what made me happy. Because I had spent so much time trying to accommodate Joe or trying to take care of our son, when it came to the point that we broke up and I had to figure out what I wanted to do and what made me happy, I freaking had no idea.
Mm. So your point is interesting. Did prior to getting married, did you know what things made you happy?
I think I was, you know, in the process of searching for that. I had just studied abroad prior to meeting Joe. And so I came home. I knew I wanted a relationship. I had never had one. And so I was like, yes, I want this. Mm. But then it was like a roller coaster. Like, I didn't know relationships include fighting and making up. I just thought if you fought, it's a bad relationship. You know, it was like all these concepts were tweaking what I felt was good. You know, it felt bad.
Yeah. I mean, and I guess that makes me add to the list of things I would recommend that people do, which is, I guess before you get married, like, take marriage training. I don't know if that exists, but it should. And, and I say that sort of, I know we're kind of laughing it, but I mean, you need a license to drive a car, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be able to prove to the state that you're not going to kill people or hurt people. You need a license to run a pretzel stand, right? Because the health department wants to be satisfied that you're not going to poison people with your pretzels. Mm-hmm. So food safety, food handling, temperatures, and that kind of a thing. But arguably the most important relationship in our lives, if you ascribe to a monogamous orientation, or one of the most important relationships in our lives is our life partner. And yet... Mm-hmm. You know how it's just, you just get the license and you can get married. No, you don't have to prove to anybody. You could be a complete train wreck.
Yeah.
Narcissist, horrible, have a million kids. There's no restrictions, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry if I'm getting a little polemical, but I'm just trying to illustrate the point that there's a crisis. There is a sort of arguably a crisis in this country in terms of people being in committed monogamous relationships that are institutionalized in the sense that they're like, you know, you have it's surrounded by the law, you know, you go through a wedding and then you have children, and there's so much of our society structured around these marriages. Mm-hmm. You know, even from a public policy standpoint, the state wants to encourage us to be married. That's fine, okay, if that's how you believe. But my big question to anybody who is in any position to think about or do anything about it is, like, why isn't there any training? When I got divorced, the state of Washington required me to attend a class a 4-hour class, I think it was, on how to be a co-parent after divorce to your children.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because cool. The state, yeah, it was fascinating because I watched, as much as I watched the video, I also watched the room, and about half the room wasn't paying attention.
Of course.
Remarkable, right? And that's some, it's remarkable. But imagine if they actually, if the state actually said, well, if you want to begin a committed relationship with someone, maybe you should get certified in some way.
Yeah.
Seems highly paternalistic, but at least, you know, it's from a voluntary standpoint, that's what I would encourage someone to do. It's like, you don't want to get divorced. Okay, I don't care if you have been divorced and happily divorced. Like, I think it was the right decision for me, no question. But I didn't want it that way, and I don't wish that upon anybody. It was a miserable, you know, it's like, you know, miserable experience that should not be repeated. And so, okay, so how do you avoid that? Well, get certified in some way by whether it's the Gottmans or whatever, but figure out what it takes, even to fight. Mm-hmm. You have to fight in the right way. Mm-hmm. You want to fight, but you don't want to, you just want to get your point across. You don't want to hurt the other person. Mm-hmm. And if you develop those bad things, that then it contributes to those salient relationship killers. Mm-hmm. So that's another wish I have on my list.
You know, maybe we can just, you know, create this marriage training course.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you say I do.
Yeah, exactly. To invest, it's worth it. Trust me, a divorce costs an average of $20,000 to $30,000. And then your rate of divorce, if you've been divorced once and you get married again, the likelihood is there's like a roughly a 60% to 70% chance you get divorced again.
Oh, my gosh.
So that tells me that, you know, you didn't get trained the first time, so you crashed the car. Mm-hmm. And then you did it again, and you crashed the car again. Well, you didn't have you had training in between? Now, I don't mean to be overly simplistic. Obviously, there are many other factors that contribute to the demise of a relationship. And I'm not saying, you know, it's always one person or it's always two people. Mm-hmm. I'm simply saying, if you're going to launch a spaceship or a rocket, which is what you know, a lifelong relationship is for someone in their mm-hmm. life. It is one of the most important projects they'll ever have, even mm-hmm. though they don't necessarily describe it as that. But it is. And wouldn't it be appropriate to invest a little bit of time and money to make sure that that rocket goes where it needs to go?
Yeah.
I could tell you that. I mean, if I knew then what I knew now, you know, maybe things would have been different. Mm-hmm. But that's another thing I think we should all consider doing.
I agree. I'm on board. If you create that or you want to do that, I'm down. I think it's necessary.
Like, awesome. I love it. I think that, yeah, it is absolutely necessary, and it will sell.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And we'll market it. We'll market the shit out of it because everyone exactly. needs it.
Absolutely. Exactly. Like I said, the numbers in that meetups group alone in a month, you know, over 100 people, I was like, holy cow.
There's a need out there and people need to be educated. And so how can people find you if they want to work with you or if they want to follow you online?
Sure. They can find me on Instagram at divorce_wisdom. They can find my website at catalyticcoaching.co. It's catalytic spelled like catalytic, like catalytic converter, catalyticcoaching.co. Or they can email me at simon@catalyticcoaching.co.
Perfect. And I'll have the links for you guys in the description. So if you want to check out Simon and his amazing coaching skills, please reach out and definitely give him a message. And as for me, you guys, that's all that we have for today. Thank you again, Simon, for being on the show today. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me, Elsie. I appreciate it.
It's been fun. The energy, like this time, like flew by. I'm looking at the clock. I'm like, oh, wow. That went
by. Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing. Holy cow, it's like a blink.
I know. All right, you guys. So again, reach out to Simon if you're interested in coaching, any kind of relationship help. He can be your guy, or just general life coaching. He is so insightful and super helpful. And be sure to tune. And I am just like all over the place.
That's how I'd be.
Right?
Normally.
All right, you guys, tune in next week as I have another story to share with you guys. And until then, I will talk to you later. Have an amazing day. Bye.